Right now, in the streets of Iraq and on military bases in this country, U.S. troops are preparing for great change. Fresh soldiers and Marines are finishing up their training, packing their supplies, and getting ready to head into the field to relieve their long-serving, combat-hardened comrades. The largest troop rotation since World War II will bring 110,000 new service members to Iraq to replace the current force of more than 130,000. This military handoff started a few weeks ago and will taper off in May. During the months of overlap, the extra forces in Iraq will strengthen the occupation, but troop movements will also make U.S. soldiers and Marines more vulnerable to attack. Later on in this hour, we'll turn our attention to the future of Disney following its rude breakup with Pixar. But now, the rotation of troops provides a window into the occupation of Iraq and illuminates uncertainties at home as well. After 2 years of hard service, experts fear soldiers may try to leave the military in vast numbers, and the increased reliance on reservists raises questions as well. At this moment of change, we take stock of where the military is headed in terms of fighting capacity, priorities, and organization. If you or a family member are involved in the troop rotation, we'd love to hear about your experience. Join the conversation. Our number in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. With us now, retired Colonel Gary Anderson, formerly of the U.S. Marines and currently serving as a consultant to the Department of Defense. He recently returned from Iraq and joins us now from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Good to have you with us, Colonel.
Good talking to you, Lynn.
Now, when the rotation gets underway, we are talking about huge numbers of people, tens of thousands of people coming in and out. When you were in Iraq, what did you see of the preparations that were being made at that time for this rotation?
Well, the units that are there that are going to be leaving are obviously doing what units do to do turnover. They prepare turnover files, prepare briefs for the new troops coming in, and generally try to get themselves and their uniforms and their equipment cleaned up and ready for the trip home.
You were in Iraq, as I understand it, to oversee the progress of training a new Iraqi army to eventually take over the defense of the country. Is that right?
No, not quite. I was there. I've been involved with the stand-up of the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps. They're the paramilitary militia that has been stood up primarily to do a lot of the counterinsurgency work and area control work. They were beginning to be formed when I made my first trip out there in July, and I just headed out to see how they're doing, where they stand. So that was the basic purpose of my visit.
Well, will they be taking the place of some of the troops that are leaving now?
That's always been the game plan there are three security services that will be engaged in taking control of the Iraqi streets as Americans go into a more of an overwatch position. One is the Facilities Protection Service, which is essentially security guards for point installations, everything from bridges to banks and things like that. The second is this Iraqi Civil Defense Corps, which, as I say, is a paramilitary militia. And the third is the Iraqi Police Service.
So once this rotation is complete, will the military presence in Iraq look different?
Eventually, it will, because the strategy is eventually to have these three Iraqi security services take over the day-to-day policing. So you will see a lot fewer Americans physically on the streets, particularly in the urban areas, patrolling and things like that, and see them more in a reaction force mode, leaving the day-to-day security operations to the Iraqis themselves.
And are the troops coming in going to be doing different tasks than those who have been there?
It'll depend initially on region per region. The stand-up of these Iraqi security forces varies depending on the place where they are and what the situation is. Let me speak to Baghdad, where I spent most of my time in the last trip. That's a pretty mature area. They have their Iraqi Civil Defense Corps troops stood up and ready to go. The police are a little bit slower to train because it takes more training to put a cop on the street, but they've got sufficient forces to get started. and they've got most of their facilities protection guys stood up. So Iraq will start to see that turnover. It's actually starting now if you reading the papers in the past few days.
Yeah, and who are the troops that are coming in? Have they seen conflict at all, or are they completely fresh troops to...
The ones coming in?
The ones that are coming in.
I really can't say. I can speak a little bit for the Marines because I went out to give a lecture out there. They're doing a pretty thorough job of getting ready to go over there, both field training and getting their cultural things in order. And from what I understand, the Army units are doing near the same thing. So I would say they're preparing, looking at lessons learned from the experience of their predecessors, and doing the things you'd normally expect professionals to do to take over take over the job from the guys that are leaving.
You mentioned cultural things, and one of the things that I've been reading in the reports about this rotation is that there are some intangibles there, and that is that part of what has happened in the time that the troops who are there now and have been there, they've built up relationships with many of the local Iraqi leaders, and that's going to be really hard to duplicate in terms of just setting up what's to come in Iraq.
I understand that some of the key players from the that were liaison will stay behind for a certain amount of time till the new guys take over and so forth. So I think they're kind of trying to cover that base, as best they can.
But that's a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a tough one. But the other there's another side of that. Of course, the troops that are there now, by and large, we're expecting to be in a larger war. And when they were trained to go over there, they trained for some specific conventional warfighting tasks where the troops that are being sent over now have had the time to acclimatize themselves to nation building and stability operations and the things that they're going to be doing. So mentally, as they go over there, I think they're going to be somewhat prepared to jump into the game and not have to retool their thinking.
We are talking about the massive rotation of troops that's now going on in Iraq. Our guest is Colonel Gary Anderson. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 989-TALK. Let's take a call now from Susan. I believe she's in Nevada. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
It's nice to be on. Thank you for taking my call. I listen to you folks every day, but this is the first time I've been able to get through.
Glad you could get on the air. Go right ahead.
My son was in the 2nd Battalion, 23rd Marine Reserve Unit that was over in Iraq at the beginning of all the events last year and went up into Baghdad. He has since come home and is, I guess, on inactive reserve right now. I was wondering if the increase in, or the rotation, I guess, would affect any of these fellows that have already served over there in the reserve units, if they would be subject to call up. They're not in a cohesive unit now. They're just individually.
And how much longer is his commitment to the reserves?
September, I believe. That will be his 8 years.
Colonel Anderson, do you know?
Boy, it's a little bit beyond my area of expertise, other than the fact that I haven't been in the Marines. I think it's probably unlikely if he's... schedule to depart the service in September that they'd do it unless he's in such a critical specialty that they absolutely need to send him back. But it's probably unlikely.
Yeah. Susan, are you hearing anything about that? Are there rumors that are flying?
No, not really. It's just a mother's concern, I guess. He's in the infantry, so he's not, anything in particular of a specialty, But... with everything that's happening over there now, of course, I worry about him.
You don't want him to go back.
No, I don't.
I think just to add to that, really the things that are highest in demand right now are things like military police to help mentor the Iraqi police, civil affairs folks, and interpreters, the specialty type units and so forth. There seem to be adequate infantry units to go around from what I could see.
It's a pretty scary place to be right now, I'm sure. So.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your call, Susan, and good luck.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Susan raises a question that I wanted to bring up to you, Colonel Anderson, and that is with all this troop movement going on, how much more vulnerable will U.S. forces be to attack by insurgents? Is there an answer to that question? I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's a fair question, and it's probably a hard question to answer, and it's dependent on the area of the country they're going into. The insurgency is won or lost a neighborhood at a time. My sensing when I was in Baghdad is an insurgency. It's pretty much gone. What you're seeing now is you're seeing terrorism, organized outside terrorism, and you're seeing some roadside bombs and things like that, which are dangerous. But from a standpoint of roving groups of people like we saw in July and things like that, that's quieted down in Baghdad. But each area of the country is a little bit different. Certainly the troops going in north and the Kurdish areas will be a lot more secure than maybe the troops going into Fallujah and places where things are a little bit still more active. So it's kind of hard to categorize across the country.
All right, let's take another call from Bob. He's in Anchorage, Alaska. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. I guess afternoon there. Colonel, I had the opportunity to go over and assist the Iraqi government with developing some laws on insurance regulation. And I'm wondering if you had a son or daughter at the age where they might go with you or might be over there, would you advise them to go in terms of security? I know they've been shooting rockets at the hotel and so forth. How safe is it for the consultants that would be assisting, and what's the prospects for that if the UN takes over in June?
Well, the first answer, my son's in the Army, so I mean, obviously he's certainly in line to go over at some point in time. From a standpoint of civilian consultants, you were probably in the green zone if you were working with the coalition authority, and as you know, it's probably one of the most heavily defended places in Iraq. Right now, insurgents are trying to take some long-range shots at hotels and things like that from anywhere from 20 to 30 kilometers away. It's, you know, light off a rocket and run. But my sensing, they shot rockets at the authority a couple of times while I was there. But my sensing is your chances of getting hurt over there about like getting hit by lightning with that kind of thing. A little bit more dangerous out on the road going with some of the IUDs and things like that. The IEDs are right now probably the most dangerous thing, particularly in the Baghdad area and the area around Baghdad.
Thanks.
Unless you're going to be a prisoner in the hotel, then you got some risk there, and I guess you would ask for a room without a view.
I'd recommend that.
Okay, thanks so much for your call, Bob. And just briefly, Colonel, I just wanted to ask you, while we're talking about some of the risks, are there some advantages at some point while this is going on? There's going to be a huge number of troops in Iraq.
For the initial period, I think the safe thing to do is, and the thing that will make the Iraqis feel best, is not to let them think that we're, for some reason, because we're rotating, that we're necessarily cutting and running. You hear a lot of blather about that in some of the media, but I think right now, when you talk to an Iraqi, they're ambivalent. They really wish you weren't so visible, but they don't want you to go. So I think eventually, if this strategy works properly, they're going to be able to withdraw to smaller and smaller troops. But I think the prudent thing right now and the thing for the Iraqi psyche is to have a similar size force so they feel that we're doing this properly and not trying to rush it so fast that we botch it.
All right, so thanks so much for joining us today, Colonel.
Sure thing.
Colonel Gary Anderson served in the U.S. Marine Corps and currently consults for the Defense Department. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the increased pressure the occupation of Iraq has put on the U.S. military and if its current size and organization are suited to the task. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. With the enormous task of rotating troops through Iraq to engage them, the logistic and tactical minds of the Pentagon may be a little occupied with the needs of the moment. But others in Washington are already using this transition to talk about possible changes to the military structure. One group with an in-depth understanding of that structure and its stresses is the RAND Corporation. Joining us now from his home in Northern Virginia is the Vice President of RAND's Army Research Division, Tom McNarr. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Lynn.
Well, there's been a lot being written these days about whether or not the Army is stretched too thin right now. What is your opinion? Is it stretched too thin?
You know, I think it is. It's a tough call, and it's one that's been the subject of debate for about 6 months between the Congress and the executive branch. But I come down gently on the side of, yeah, it's time to start expanding this force. You know, there's about 180,000 Army troops deployed overseas, most of them in Iraq, but also, you know, Afghanistan, Korea, Bosnia, Kosovo. When you're trying to sustain a long-term deployment like that overseas, you think in terms of a rotation base. How many units do you have back here so that you can keep one overseas? And the tightest rotation base is probably you have three units. One of them is overseas. One of them's recovering from just having been overseas, and another one's getting ready to go. And that's pretty tight. At the moment, though, I think the U.S. Army, if you take up all its deployments and then you look at the size of the total Army, the active Army, the National Guard, and the Army Reserves, you're just about at 3-1. You'd like to be a little bigger, 5-1, because the Army's doing more than just servicing Iraq and Korea. It has to be ready for a war in Korea. It has to send people to schools. It has to do a whole lot of other things. And so, you know, you'd have to say the Army's stretched too thin now. I think the administration's view is, yeah, that's true, but 6 months from now, a year from now, Iraq will be a lot better, and the pressure will be off. And that may be true, but I think it's every bit as easy to argue that Iraq's going to stay the same or even perhaps require more troops.
And, of course, the argument that you hear made frequently, too, is what if something unexpected happens?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, war in Korea is the obvious one. But, you know, in 2 years of the war on terrorism, we've picked up two major occupations, Afghanistan and Iraq. Who's to say we aren't going to pick up something else in the next 2 years? And that'll put more stress on.
Yeah.
And since you can't really get an army overnight, you know, if you want 30,000, 40,000 more soldiers, it takes a few years to get them. You ought to start those wheels turning now.
Well, there is authorization to increase the size of the military, at least temporarily, correct?
That is a compromised position. The General Schoomaker, the present Army Chief of Staff, surfaced, I think, in testimony last week or the week before. And I think it's a good one because, on the one hand, it gets the wheels turning. They're going to start increasing the size of the Army in a serious way. On the other hand, that word temporary allays the concerns of the Bush administration that, you know, you're going to incur the long-term costs of adding people to the services, and that's a lot of money.
And it's increased by 30,000 troops, is that right?
Well, yeah, but, you know, I don't think anybody should worry about the end number. The issue, I think, to me is let's get the wheels going. Let's start increasing the size of the Army. You know, a year from now, you may actually want more than 30,000, or you may not. So I wouldn't worry about 30,000. That's just sort of a marker out there to get things started.
And what about the stop loss order that has recently been issued? That's intended to keep returning troops from de-enlisting? Is that how that works?
Actually, the stop loss has been around since just after 9/11 in various forms. Sometimes it's been focused selectively on specific skills that are in short supply. Sometimes it's more general. What it does is, if you're in Iraq and your enlistment comes up, you're not coming home from Iraq until your unit does, and then usually you have to stay another 90 days, and then you can get out. So it artificially constrains departures from the military.
Yeah, and that could not be good for morale, I would think.
Well, you know, judging from some of the articles in the Washington Post lately, especially in the reserve components, it incurs a lot of anger. You know, if you want to increase the size of the Army, you can do it with a stop loss. In fact, the Army right now is larger than its authorized end strength by a good bit, but you don't want to do it with stop loss. You want to do it with reenlistment bonuses, by recruiting more people and so forth, and actually getting a legitimate addition to the force of people who want to stay there.
You know, I don't know if we had a caller earlier, and we didn't have an answer for this this woman whose son was in the reserves. She wanted to know if her son, who has already served in Iraq, was likely to be called up again. He's a reservist. Do you know how reservists are affected by this?
Well, the reservists certainly have a stop loss, although, you know, I confess I'm not really aware of the fine print. My hunch would be that if her son has come back from a tour in Iraq and waited the obligatory 90 days, probably he can get out of the reserves. If he stays in the reserves, you know, chances are he's going to do another tour. It won't be right away, but, you know, Iraq could be a long-term commitment here.
We're talking about the rotation of troops in Iraq. Our guest right now is Tom McNarr. He's vice president of the Army Research Division of the RAND Corporation. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. Let's take a call from Chuck, and he's in New Jersey. Hi, Chuck.
Yes, hi, Lynn.
Go ahead.
Yes, I have some concern about this rotation. I served over 3 years of active duty in the 3rd Armored Division in West Germany. And at that time, we would rotate soldiers in one at a time and then rotate them back home one at a time or in small groups. During the Vietnam War, it's my understanding that if a combat soldier, could survive the first couple of weeks in country, that he was much more likely to return home safely. In a situation where we are rotating entire units, because we don't have a draft and because we don't now rotate people individually, the experience of the entire unit that has spent perhaps a year in Iraq is being lost. And the new unit that's coming in may have a liaison officer or NCO who may be familiar with the in-country customs and culture, but the ratio of those liaison people might be 1 in 500, one liaison officer or NCO for each of the 500 new troops coming in. It seems to me that the new troops are going to be extremely vulnerable and are going to suffer much more substantially because of their lack of experience. And I think that could be avoided if somehow we could be rotating people individually.
You know, Chuck, you've hit on an extremely interesting point. It's a matter of choice, by the way. It's not a matter of the draft versus the volunteer force. To make it clear, you can rotate units, which is what we're going to do here in the next few months in Iraq, or you can do it the way we did in Vietnam, which is you leave the unit in Vietnam back then. You left it in Vietnam, and then you just rotated people through it. Mm-hmm. And the advantage of the latter, the individual rotation, is that on any given day, you know, more than half of the people in that unit have a lot of experience. They know the local terrain, the people, they know how to fight in that particular environment. The advantage of rotating units, I think, or at least the advantage the Army attaches to it, is that if you keep people together, they train together, all of them know one another very well, you have a highly cohesive unit, and they're more effective. But I do think, and I don't think this is news to the Pentagon, I do think that there's an effectiveness, an initial entry problem that's really somewhat dangerous, and I think the Pentagon's trying to deal with that by having these units overlap for at least 2 weeks. It wouldn't surprise me if some of the units in Iraq have sent people back to the units that are going to replace them to talk about what they're going to get into. There's a real serious effort to transfer knowledge, but inevitably, I think, when these new units get in there, it's going to take them a while to gear up and figure out what's going on. So you've identified a concern.
Thanks.
Even the kind of experience that would be associated with dealing with the climate, the extraordinary temperatures, and how to regulate your body temperatures and consume water at the proper rate and not overexert yourself under adverse conditions. I think all those things in aggregate are extremely important. And we're going to suffer enormously, I think. That is, those soldiers going in will suffer enormously as a result of that lack of firsthand experience.
All right. So thanks you so much for your call, Chuck. Let's take another call from Alphonse, and he is in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Alphonse.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Lynn. This is Al Hunt. First of all, I wanted to thank you for your topic today. I'm a member of the North Carolina National Guard, and we're preparing for deployment and have just completed about 5 months of train-up. And I was surprised when I first got home for a couple of days not to hear much at all in the news or the national media regarding the situation in Iraq. It was kind of refreshing for me personally, anyhow, to hear this topic on the radio.
And did you have any question or a comment you wanted to make?
Well, I was listening to your last caller, and he was mentioning what was done in Vietnam in terms of individual rotation. I've been training with the same group of guys for 5 months now, living with them, fighting mock battles, and I feel that the unit rotation is a good way to go because we all know each other extremely well, probably better than we want to. We know each other's strengths and weaknesses, and in any given situation, at least in training, we work well by capitalizing on what we're good, what people are good at what skills, and also being aware of what we're not so good at.
All right. Thanks for your call, Al.
All right. Thank you.
I was wondering, Tom McNair, whether you rotate troops in individually or as a unit, and you were saying that in Vietnam they did it individually. Was that one of the lessons they feel they learned from Vietnam, that was a mistake, and that's why now their Pentagon might be inclined to move entire troops?
Well, no, I think this is a debate that goes back and forth in the Army, and it has for many, many decades, actually. There was a strong feeling that if you keep units together and train them together, you get exactly the kinds of advantages that Al Hunt just mentioned on the phone. People know one another. They just know how they're going to respond. Really effective units. I think the counterargument is that especially in stability operations where your ability to know the local situation and the people, the context among the Iraqis or 30 years ago the Vietnamese, maybe it's even more important that you have individual rotations so on any given day a lot of the unit is really into what's going on in the region and only 20% maybe of the unit is new and getting acquainted with it. It's a choice the Army has chosen to make. The current chief of staff, I think, it feels very strongly that the strengths that Al talked about a minute ago are the ones you want to pursue, and so they're going to go to unit rotations.
Tom McNair is the vice president of the Army Research Division of the RAND Corporation, and I'd like to bring another guest in on the discussion now. Thomas Donnelly of the American Enterprise Institute has written extensively about the need to expand the military. He joins us now from their offices in Washington, D.C. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Lynn.
Mr. Donnelly, during the invasion of Afghanistan and in prior conflicts, the emphasis seems to have been on technology-driven swift victories. Does the situation in Iraq, the need for a continued U.S. presence in Afghanistan, does that mean that emphasis should be shifting to the needs of long-term engagements now?
Well, yes, but it doesn't mean that we should sacrifice, the advantages that won us both wars in the first place. It's just that this is the other side of the coin, and we were not simply interested in punishing the Taliban or Saddam's regime. We were interested in replacing both of them with something better, and that was always going to be a longer-term project and prospect, and at least given what our strategic goal says, we need to be able to do both.
And in terms of the long-term occupation, this requires an expanded military?
I would say it does. I just heard my good friend Tom McNair talking about the demands of stability operations. And this is a dilemma that has been a real one for the Army in particular, even going back to the rotations through the Balkans in the 1990s. You could see that this was a kind of a mission that was becoming more commonplace, yet the leadership of the Pentagon very much focused on getting more bang for the buck, military transformation, and essentially increasing the efficiency with which we delivered firepower. But these are not real rock'em sock'em firepower missions by any stretch.
We are talking about the troop rotation currently going on in Iraq, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tom McNair, I just want to return to you. Would you, in your opinion, is the military currently set up for these kinds of long-term occupations? And if not, how hard would it be to change the military's focus?
Well, actually, all through the 90s, and in fact all through the Cold War, the primary mission of the Army was, preparing to fight fairly big wars, the Soviets in the Cold War, and then two major contingencies in the 90s. And so they've always been able to do these, but they aren't ideally structured for doing stability operations. And given that there are still some big wars out there, like Korea, you wouldn't want to move them all the way over. I think though that if you think that you're going to be doing things like Iraq and Afghanistan for the long term, and I think that's a reasonable bet, you'd probably want to increase the proportion of your force that's MPs, civil military police, civil affairs, other skills that are more useful in stability operations, perhaps, than in major war. And you also, I think, would want to expand your training, especially of your leaders, to include how do you understand stability operations? How do you operate in that environment? Because it's not at all the same thing as operating in a major war.
Right,
so, yeah, there's some changes, but I don't think they're impossible. They just have to be done.
I want to take a call from Diana. She's in Turkey. Diana, hi. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for letting me get on today.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm listening to this program, and it's very interesting to me because I'm very close to where things are going on. I'm in Turkey. I'm a contractor to the government, and I am also a retired Air Force member. And it's very interesting regarding the troop strength. The Army, of course, is first on the ground anywhere we go normally. And as the Air Force side of it, I can see here at the base I work at how strained these airmen are, and everything is concentrating on supporting what's going on downrange. And with all the support that we have going on here in this part of the world, we are so strained on troops that if something were to break out somewhere else, as was mentioned earlier in the year with a possibility of something going wrong in Korea, how could we respond to that?
Let me ask Thomas Donnelly to respond to that question.
Well, that was a very real concern in the run-up to the war in Iraq, and there's no question that we took a risk and continue to take risks in being able to do other things. Some of the units, troop listed for this second rotation in Iraq, are, at least formally speaking, members of the division that is currently stationed in Korea. So we're the U.S. Army, and indeed all the services in different ways, but especially the Army, are really thinly stretched. And it's curious that since the Bush administration has really changed the orientation of our national security strategy, it has done almost nothing to change the structure or the strength, the manpower strength of the armed services.
Oh, I totally agree with that statement. It just seems like the more every time you turn around, people are just getting out. The people that have the high quality skills, the air traffic controllers, the communications people, they get big bonuses. They do enough time in the service to get a good bonus, put it in savings for a couple years, and then they take off.
Thanks so much for your call, Diana. We're going to have to take a break now.
Okay.
We're talking about the structure of U.S. military. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Today we're talking about the massive troop rotation in Iraq and how it illustrates the strengths and weaknesses of our current military structure. Next week at this time, we'll look at troop rotation from the other side and talk with families about what it's like to have their loved ones heading over or coming back from Iraq. Right now, Thomas Donnelly of the American Enterprise Institute is with us, and also Tom McNarr, Vice President of Army Research Division of the RAND Corporation. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're going to take a call now from Enrique, and he's in Florida. Hi.
Hi, Lynn.
Go ahead.
I'm Enrique, and I'm stationed on one of the ships out here in Mayport, Florida. We are also taking part in a lot of the actions that are taking place in Iraq, but from a different side. Unlike the troops that are out in the desert, we have to sit out in the sea and maintain the sea lanes being open going into the Iraq area in the Persian Gulf. And what's happening with us is we are being told that we could be extended for anywhere from 6 months on our normal rotation to 9 months. And a lot of our smaller ships in the local areas are also moving up on how long they're going to stay, and their staffing problems are very hard at this time because we've got a lot of junior sailors that are coming in, opposed to the days when we used to go. We still there?
Yeah, we're still here.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
In opposed to the days when we used to say come to the Navy and see the world, now it's come to the Navy and we will send you to Bahrain and we will send you to very limited ports because it's so hard for us to pull into safe areas these days, and our time where we're out to sea is getting longer and the training cycles are getting longer. It's getting very discouraging for the junior sailors to keep their morale up and encourage more people to come in.
All right, if I can ask you to just listen, I'm going to have our guests respond to that because you're raising a very good point, Enrique. Thanks so much for calling us. And that's a question of morale and what it means when troops are have to go back into a combat zone where they've been before or have to stay on duty longer than they want to. Thomas Donnelly.
You can look at that in two really different ways, and the data that I've seen, and Tom may want to comment on this, is you can read both ways. In some ways, it's just extraordinarily remarkable how much of this rotation stuff soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines will take. And that is also true of National Guardsmen and reservists. 40% of the second rotation in Iraq is going to be reserve components, and that's just in something we never anticipated, and the fact that these people are doing it is just remarkable. That said, there are some really sort of nerve-wracking trends that are afoot. There was deep concern that the Army was not going to meet its recruiting goals for the National Guard and the Reserve. And in particular, one of the ways in which they're going to try to meet the need in Iraq and have done is by employing what is known as a stop-loss order, which essentially prevents people from ending their term of service. And now it's going to go back on again in order to try to increase the end strength of the Army. That could really be a penny-wise and pound-foolish policy to try to avoid a permanent increase, and coming on top of the really lousy way in which personnel policies were managed during the war, I would be really very nervous about the issue of troop morale, and particularly the propensity to reenlist and the word that will go back home to a whole host of American communities. I think the word is kind of on the street. If you join the Navy or join the military, you're going to a lot of hot, dry, dusty places, and that's what your career is likely to be.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today to both of my guests. Thomas Donnelly is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He joined us this afternoon from their offices here in Washington. And Tom McNarr is the vice president of the RAND Corporation's Army Research Division and director of their Arroyo Center, operated in conjunction with the U.S. Army. He joins us today from his home in Northern Virginia.